The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. I am your host, Bill Donahue. It is the 19th day of May in 2024, in case you're just waking up. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us across the way taking care of business. And up first tonight, we will speak to author Noah Gittell about his book, Baseball the Movie. We will then switch gears, as is our wont every once in a while, and we'll welcome in a very special guest, the guitarist from Sir Paul McCartney's Tight as a Drum Band, Rusty Anderson, will join us. At 9 o'clock, we will welcome in our official scorer at games for the local clubs and an author of some renown. Howie Carpin comes by to discuss his book on the history of sports phone. The book is 976-1313, which, if you're old like me, you'll recognize as the number of sports phone. Finally, we'll switch gears once again. Welcome in a true legend, another great guitar player, Randy Bachman. He's going to join us, so sit back, relax, get yourself a drink and a snack, and enjoy the show tonight. We're going to be a special show tonight for you folks. As always, social media. I'd like to speak with you about that, if I may. You can follow me on Facebook. My page is called The Talk of New York Sports. Show information, sports information, photos, so much more. Stop by, take a look. You can also follow us on X at Sports Talk New York. And you can follow me on X at B Donahue, D-O-N-O-H-U-E-W-G-B-B. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're out on the website at www.sportstalknewyork.com. You can catch up anytime you want. Well, our first guest, he has written a book with the subject matter close to my heart. It's baseball movies. If you listen to me for a while, you know that we do a segment on occasion called Baseball at the Movies. This book delves into the genre with a fervor. The book is titled Baseball the Movie, and it is written by Noah Gittell. Welcome to Sports Talk New York, Noah.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you aboard, Noah. Now, I know you were recently the guest of some wonderful and talented friends of mine on the Baseball and Barbecue Show. Folks who may not know, the hosts are Len and Jeff. Just want to give a quick plug. They have a great podcast on two of their favorite subjects, which is baseball and barbecue. Two fine gentlemen. You can find their website at Baseball and Barbecue, baseballandbbq.weedly.com. They're on Apple Podcasts, and Len and Jeff at Baseball and Barbecue, that is. They did a segment with Noah. It's out there. Go check it out. Now, what started you, Noah, as a baseball fan, teams, players, and then we'll ask about movies.
Sure. Well, I grew up in the New York area. I was born in 1980. So what happened in this part of the world in 1986 was incredibly important to me. That was the first time I saw magic in the universe. And it couldn't have come at a better time. I was just really excited and moved by that 86 team. And that's it. I was hooked for life on baseball, and I'm still a Mets fan to this day.
I'm sorry to hear that, Noah.
So
am I. So except for two or three years, I felt the pain of that. So you can imagine, I was 10 years old in 69, so I remember that fairly vividly. But other than that, they kill me, and I'm sure you'll agree.
It's rough, but you know what? It's true what they say. It builds character.
It builds character. That's it, Noah. Yeah. Now, you don't only speak about baseball films, but all genres of film, correct?
Yeah, I've been a film critic for the last 10 or 12 years, doing freelance work for various outlets, including The Atlantic and The Ringer and The Guardian and a bunch of others.
Nice. Okay. Now, baseball through the years, Noah, it's been a symbol of America as much as a sport, kind of a blend of individual achievement in confrontation and team play in an urban parkland setting. Now, it offers a sunny rendering of the American dream, so to speak, both the hard work that underpins it and the rewards that it promises, right?
Yeah, you nailed it exactly. You know, this book goes through the whole history of baseball movies, really starting around the Pride of the Yankees, although I do talk a little bit about the films that came before that, mm-hmm. all the way to the present. And so you can track the changes in American culture through looking at the changes in this genre over the years. And the truth is, you could kind of do this with any genre that's been around this long. You could write a similar book about horror movies or certainly about Westerns. But the baseball movie is this fundamentally American symbol because it is the national game and because that's how it's been used in film. So it really is the perfect genre through which to, like, take this approach.
And film, Noah, it's really America's other pastime. It takes all it touches and magnifies it mythologically in that way.
Yeah.
And it's been really the ideal medium to sort of canonize that idea.
Yeah, and it's so funny because baseball and movies have sort of walked together throughout history. You know, they were both born in the 19th century. They became very popular in the early 20th century for people who lived in cities, you know, which were rapidly growing at that time. Baseball and movies were the main sources of entertainment. They were in your neighborhood. They were near your house. They were cheap. People did them all the time. And they have both sort of fought off threats over the years to their dominance atop American culture, whether it's other sports or other kinds of entertainment or, you know, McCarthyism for film, whatever mm-hmm. it would be. And they fought them off for a long time together. And now they're both still very popular, but they also have both sort of fallen from their perch atop American culture. And it's just fascinating to see both of them kind of always in the same place, in the pecking order throughout
very,
history.
Very true, Noah. Yes, very true. Now, the book is really a definitive history, as we say, of the genre, that was born in 1915. How is it brought in 1915? What was the film?
I don't remember the name of the first film, but the first really big film came in 1920, and that was a movie that actually starred Babe Ruth, and it was called Heading Home. And Babe
okay.
Ruth starred basically as himself in a mythologized version of himself. And that was not a good movie. And in fact, a lot of the baseball movies in those early years were not very good. It wasn't until Pride of the Yankees, I think, that they really figured out what to do with a baseball movie. To have some baseball, have some romance, have some drama. I think that was sort of the golden ticket, as it were. And for many years after that, they were sort of riffing on that same idea over and over again because it was so successful.
Yes, Pride of the Yankees. Yes, definitely a good start there. We're speaking with Noah Gittel tonight, the author of Baseball, the Movie. Now, in your book, you sort of get the impression that everything there is to know about baseball is in there and movies and how
yeah.
they intersect. How did you come to these topics, Noah? It seems like a lifelong interest of yours.
Absolutely. You know, as I said, I was a kid. I loved baseball. I didn't know that I was in the middle of a baseball movie boom, the likes of which had never come before and would never come again. In the 80s and early 90s, there were two or three really good baseball movies coming out every year. And for a young fan, I think baseball movies really supported my burgeoning passion for the game. Because, you know, watching the game on TV as a kid or at the stadium, you don't know anything about the players. And we certainly didn't back then. We didn't know what the 86 Mets were up to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we do know now what they were up to. But the baseball movie sort of fills in the gaps, right? They tell you about these guys, what they talk about in the clubhouse, on the team bus, in a mound conference. They tell you, like in Bull Durham, what is the one word you can't say to an umpire or else you're going to get kicked out of the game.
Right.
It really completes the picture of who these people are, what their hopes are, their fears are, their dreams are. And when you're a young fan learning the game, that really helps support your fandom. So I love these movies from the beginning, and I continue to love them today.
it really works in tandem with baseball, with the sport itself.
Yeah, exactly right. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we don't have as many baseball movies today being made, and the sport is not quite as popular as it once was, especially among younger people. I mean, the sport needs baseball movies, and I hope MLB is talking to somebody in Hollywood and trying to figure out how to make the next great one, because I think they really need it.
I agree, Noah. Yes. Now, in the book, you talk about baseball being especially cinematic and that it being especially, quote-unquote, Hollywood. Are those kind of the same things?
Yes and no. I think when I say the sport is cinematic, I mean just the geometry of the sport. You know, I mean, other sports, football, basketball, and hockey, I mean, they sort of just go left to right on your screen or right to left. Baseball is three-dimensional in a way that I think lends itself to cinema. It also has a lot of stillness in it, a lot of time to sort of contemplate what is going on. I think that plays really well on film. And as you mentioned earlier, it is a team sport, but it's also an individual sport. And that one-on-one confrontation between the batter and the pitcher, I mean, that reminds me of a Western, of a duel a lot of times in film. And I think there's something in baseball that just harkens back to the fundamental nature of movies themselves, and that's why they make such good movies.
Now, you talk a little bit about baseball films as validating American ideas about optimism, hard work, a meritocracy, and personal sacrifice. How do films do that?
Well, I would say they do that especially in the post-war era. After the Pride of the Yankees came out, there were a rash of imitators, movies about talented players who are plucked out of nowhere and get to the major leagues and succeed and then have to overcome certain obstacles or struggles. They made the Stratton story about Monty Stratton, a great pitcher who lost a leg in a hunting accident and came back to pitch professional ball. They made the Winning Team about Grover Cleveland Alexander, who suffered alcoholism and got over and continued to play. And these film, and you know, the Jackie Robinson story would fall into that category as well. He had to overcome the racism, the abuse and harassment that he perceived. So I think these films really help build the image of the American dream in a lot of ways, because they show that the sport is democratic. It is a meritocracy. As you say, these guys are plucked out of nowhere and become the greatest players in the sport because they can hit, they get everything they want. They get a wife, they get a family, they get a house in the suburbs. These are the building blocks of the American dream. And baseball was seen as the most democratic sport, lends itself to that sort of symbolism.
Exactly. Well put, Noah. Now, you speak about ways that the baseball films can change with the political climate of the day. Let's expand on that a bit.
Definitely. So a great example there is the baseball films of the 1970s. The 1970s were obviously a tumultuous time for this country. The disillusionments of Watergate, Kent State, the Vietnam War. I mean, we were a people who were wrestling with what America means and what our culture signified. And I think in the baseball films of this era, you really see that. The triumph and optimism of the earlier baseball films is sort of gone. And you get movies like The Bad News Bears that ends with a loss. You know, I mean, you have these cursing, fighting kids, which is pretty subversive in and of itself, going up against the evil Yankees, you know, Lou Gehrig's cherished Yankees, and they're evil in The Bad News Bears, and then it ends with them actually losing, which is unheard of in a baseball film for this time. Not a baseball film, but it's the same year that Rocky came out, another film that doesn't end with a win, but it's still seen as a moral victory. And I think for a nation that was kind of wrestling with what it means to be victorious in the wake of the Vietnam War, those films had a lot to say. I think you could also point to Bang the Drum Slowly, which has a lot in common with The Pride of the Yankees. It's about a New York player who has a deadly disease and gets sicker and sicker over the course of the film. But again, there's no dignity to it. It's not like his death inspires a nation or anything like that. It's a long, slow fade out for that character, in which the people around him learn to be a little bit nicer, really, and they give him a good final season. So the tone of these films was so very different than the tone of the post-war films, and that's because the tone of the country.
Yeah, the Bang the Drum Slowly film is very underrated and kind of forgotten when people talk about baseball films today. I think that should be given more recognition, that film, definitely. So you're speaking about the character of the nation, really, Noah. What would be a film that talks about the American character?
Yeah, well, several of the ones I've mentioned, I think, reveal that character. Mm-hmm. You know, 8 Men Out is another film that has a lot to do with this country and its views on entertainment and corruption and economics. John Sayles, who made this film about the 1919 Chicago Black Sox scandal, you know, he's a very well-known working-class left-wing filmmaker, and he looked at the story of these guys who were thrown out of baseball, and he said, you know, this is a story about a working man being trampled by big business, essentially. Mm-hmm. They did what they had to do, in his opinion, because they were not getting paid enough. They were getting cheated out of money by their very cheap owner, Charles Comiskey, and he has a lot of sympathy for the guys who took this money. Some of them he paints, you know, like they're not such great guys. But many of the others, he has a lot of sympathy for them, who are guys who are trying to provide for their families, and they're not getting their fair share of the profits. And, you know, he wrote this movie. It didn't come out till 88, I think, but he wrote it in the 70s. He saw it as a conspiracy movie, like All the President's Men or something like that. And, of course, it's imbued with that spirit of realism and cynicism that characterized a lot of the other 70s films that we discussed.
We're speaking with Noah Gittell tonight, author of Baseball, the movie. John Sayles, incidentally, wrote the foreword to Noah's book.
Yeah.
So when you pick that up, you'll be able to see it. Now, you talk about Bingo Long in the book, Noah. And you also say there hasn't been really a Hollywood baseball movie about race and racism. Why isn't that movie, and why hasn't that movie been made yet?
Well, I'll say there hasn't been one, I think, that really got it right, that told the real story of race in baseball. There have been some admirable attempts, and I think Bingo Long is one of them. Incidentally, this is a movie a lot of people don't know about. It was a big hit at the time,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't really have a legacy because I think it told some stories about, race in baseball that people didn't really want to hear at that time. It's about a group of Negro leaguers who are fed up with the way they're being treated, not unlike the characters in 8 Men Out, and they decide to create their own team, a barnstorming team. They're going to travel across the country, play whoever they can for how much ever money they can get, and put on a good show. And it really does show viewers what the Negro Leagues were like. And in the 1970s, there really wasn't a lot of awareness about it anymore. Black players were doing very well in the major leagues, and the stories of the Negro Leagues were kind of shuffled off to the side. And the film shows that, and it also reckons with a really more complicated reality, which is that integration in baseball, the wonderful thing that it was, also decimated the Negro League, essentially led to their demise within a decade or so, and obliterated these black cultural centers that the Negro League teams were. And Bingo Long, for all the fun that it is, watching these guys goof around and essentially act like the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball, it also wrestles with that complicated reality, and that's why I think it's a valuable film in spite of some of its flaws.
Yeah, that's another underrated film for sure, Noah. I can see that. Now, most baseball movies today, their point of view is often conservative, correct?
Mm. I think baseball is inherently baseball in our culture is usually depicted conservatively because it's a nostalgic game. And when we talk about nostalgia, what we're talking about is looking at the past and saying, how great was that? And inherent in that is this notion that things were better before there was certain kinds of progress. And you do see that in movies. You see it in movies like The Natural and movies like The Sandlot. Mm-hmm. Any baseball movie that's set in the past usually has some complicated politics that we have to wrestle with.
Yeah, I understand that, Noah. Now, the movie Sugar is mentioned mm-hmm. in the book, and that's an interesting film to talk about.
I'm so glad you're mentioning these movies that are not part of the baseball movie canon. They, not everybody knows about them, but
right.
This is why I wanted to write about them, because they should be. Sugar is a fascinating movie. It came out in 2009. It was a small movie, independently made, didn't get a huge theatrical release. And again, it told some stories that MLB wasn't keen to be talking about. It's about a Dominican-born player, a very low-income person who comes over to the U.S. to start his professional career. He's drafted and he's sent to the minor leagues. And he's sent to Iowa, where he doesn't speak the language. He's with a host family that he can't communicate with. And he's very isolated and alone. He doesn't even know how to order breakfast at a diner. There's a very poignant scene about that. Mm-hmm. And he finds some success right away, and then he struggles. He struggles on the field and off the field. And it's a movie about what happens to most of the players who come to this country on a minor league contract, which is that most of them don't get to the majors. Most of them flame out. And this is about that kind of person. And I don't think MLB really wants us talking about that kind of person, because they don't want us thinking about, you know, are we exploiting these developing nations, questions like that. But Sugar asks those questions, and it does them in a really character-driven way that makes it all the more effective. It's a great movie, and I hope more people see it.
I agree, Noah. Yeah, there's some politics right there, too, with Sugar. Now, as a baseball purist, I find some of the inaccuracies in these movies kind of offensive. It makes me upset, which I should really turn my attention to more important things. But you take Ray Liotta as a right-hand hitter, and some of the legends in the Babe Ruth story. I mean, is it just for theater?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it bothers me too. Even in the most ridiculous movies, it bothers me. And I'll give you an example. There's a film called Rookie of the Year that came out when I was 13 about a kid who breaks his arm, and the tendons heal too tight, and all of a sudden he can throw 95 miles an hour, and he gets signed by the Chicago Cubs to be a starting pitcher. Now, that's not the part that bothers me for its lack of realism. The part that bothers me is the setup, which is that the Cubs are so bad, and they're drawing so few fans that the owners are going to have to sell the team if they don't bring more fans in, and that's why they signed this kid. Well, anybody who knows baseball knows the one team that never has a problem drawing fans, good or bad, is the Chicago Cubs. In fact, I found a statistical analysis that showed this. They are their attendance is the most impervious to their one loss record of any major league team. And this movie suggests that nobody is showing up to watch a bad Cubs team. And it's almost like they picked the worst franchise for this concept to play out. And that seems less realistic to me than the kid breaking his arm and all of a sudden being able to throw 100.
Yeah, that's true, Noah, definitely. Why do you think there are more films about baseball than any other sport?
Well, I think they got started early, for one. You know, they were making baseball movies as early as, we said, you know, 1915, 1920. And football was not nearly as popular then. Basketball basically didn't exist yet. So there's a longer history for baseball. Baseball is also just more part of our history as Americans. I mean, we know the stories about soldiers playing it on the Civil War battlefields, and the Cooperstown myth is kind of synonymous with the American story. And I think baseball is so useful as a way to talk about America. There's something so elemental about it, as if it almost sprung from the land itself. But I also do think it's more cinematic, as we discussed earlier. I think it's easier to film because there's less constant motion and complicated choreography. And I think I do, just to go back to it, the idea of the pitcher facing down that batter, it is a fundamental American image, like Clint Eastwood versus Lee Van Cleef in a Sergio Leone movie.
Right.
These are the images of our culture, and baseball plays right into it.
Now let's talk about you, Noah. What is your favorite baseball movie?
You know, I actually think it's A League of Their Own, which we haven't talked about yet.
Right.
Reason I think it's the best is because it just has everything you want in a movie, in addition to being a good baseball movie. It's got comedy. It's got drama. It's got tragedy. It's got a dance sequence. It's got great baseball in it. It's got a character-driven story that makes the baseball all the more powerful. And it's got this incredible unanswered question at the end of it. It did Dottie Hinson drop that ball on purpose that people are still debating today? And that's the kind of thing that makes baseball movies really important to the game. Here we are 30 years later talking about this moment in a movie, not even in real life baseball. And I just think you have to give so much credit to the filmmakers for putting together an incredible movie, but then also creating this indelible moment that it's on a movie.
There's also in A League of Our Own, Noah, one of the most famous lines uttered in the movie with "There's no crying in baseball." That was voted as one of the top quotes from a movie.
Yes, exactly. That's another part of it that lives on forever. Everybody knows that quote.
Yeah. And like you say, it's got so much in it that you can enjoy. Marla Hooch, what an amazing character that is. And you have go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, she was great. I love Marla Hooch in that movie, and that's the kind of character, you know, you only get that in a movie about women baseball players. There's no male equivalent. You know, that is so specific to its women, and that's the thing I love about that movie. It doesn't just take the male baseball archetypes and, you know, impose them on women. It really creates a story that is feminine sensibility. And I really appreciate that. I think that's what makes it great.
Yeah, true. Very true. What do you think is the best baseball film ever made? Would you go with A League of Their Own?
I have a hard time separating best from favorite, to be honest with you.
Right,
but League of Their Own is up there. The Natural's up there, too. I think that's it's a great movie and an important movie because it was the first movie that was a hit baseball movie for a long time, and it really helped pave the way for the baseball movies that followed. But I have to say, I think Bull Durham has to be in the conversation, too, because that's the only baseball movie I know that was made by somebody who actually played the game. Ron Shelton, who wrote and directed it, was a minor leaguer for many years, did not get to the majors, but he knew of what he wrote. And when you watch that movie, you learn so much about the game. You learn the lingo. You learn the dynamics between pitchers and catchers and players and umpires. So when I talked earlier about how these movies supported my burgeoning fandom of the game, Bull Durham is probably the best example of that because it teaches you so much.
And there's another classic line in that movie, Noah, with candlesticks, right?
Of course. That was an incredible scene because Ron Shelton knew, if I'm going to make a baseball movie, I'm competing with baseball on television. And he said, I got to take you places that television can't take you. And one place it could not have taken us was at a pitcher's a mound conference where the pitcher and the infield and the catcher and the coach are talking. And we always have wondered, what are they talking about? And he gave us an idea. I don't know how realistic that was, how much he was playing for comedy versus realism. But at least he showed us something, and he showed us something entertaining.
Right, and it went over hugely, and it was a tremendous success. Well, Noah, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for taking your time out of your Sunday night to spend some of it with us here at WGBB. We wish you all the best with the book. Again, folks, it's called Baseball the Movie, written by Noah Gittell, and thank you very much, Noah.
My pleasure. Can I do one quick plug?
Yes, go right ahead. Go ahead.
I'm going to be in Brooklyn on Thursday night at Word Bookstore doing a book promotion and a conversation with John DeMarsico, who is the director of the Mets SNY telecast.
Nice. Nice event, folks. And where can people go to get directions, et cetera, Noah? Is there a site for Word?
Yeah, you could go to the Word Bookstore site. It's the Greenpoint location where we're going to be. Or you could just go to my website, noahgittell.com, and you'll get all the information on that.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Noah, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks, Bill. Have a good one.
You too. That's Noah Gittell, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we switch gears and welcome in Paul McCartney, his guitar player, the great Rusty Anderson. Stick around, folks.
You are listening. listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we are back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB. I would like to thank you for stopping by and hanging with us on this Sunday evening here on Long Island. Our next guest, he's known for his work as the lead guitarist for Paul McCartney's touring band since 2001, but he's worked with an extensive list of other artists in addition to his own solo career, which all will be discussed with him this evening. I welcome to the show tonight Rusty Anderson. Rusty, good evening.
Hello there. How are you, Bill?
We're doing great. We're doing great. I hope all is well with you.
Yeah, man. I just took a shower and ready for the interview on the radio.
Ready for action. All right, here we go.
Yeah, clean interview.
Yeah. Well, you have been with Paul McCartney longer than the Beatles that were together.
This is true, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's been a good lot of fun. We're still going, man. It's great.
Yeah, and I've seen a couple of shows, and I know how great that is. Let's talk about the appearance at the Super Bowl.
Okay. The Super Bowl, that was one of the earlier things we did. Actually, we played there twice. The first Super Bowl was the sort of first real gig with this band, this lineup. Mm-hmm. And then we played there in 2005. And that was really cool. I'm trying to remember. I'm so bad at sports. I apologize. But anyway, it was 2005, and it was really fun to watch the game, go down there and play, you know.
Yeah.
And then they had the whole, like, rent-a crowd and everything, and we're all, like, rocking it. And then we go back up to watch, you know, finish watching the game. And I looked on the field, and there was not a speck of paper, nothing left from, you know, us playing.
Yeah.
As if we never played. It's really crazy. But it was a lot of fun. It was a really good game, too. I wish I could remember who played.
Now, yeah, I don't remember either, Rusty. Don't worry. The Olympics in London.
Yeah, man. That was another fun gig. That was just out of control. It was so big, you know.
Yeah.
There was this giant bell above us, and I don't know. That was a spectacle.
For sure.
Yeah, we played a lot of shows. You know, we did Red Square and Dodger Stadium, Tokyo Dome, the White House during the Obama era.
Right. I want to ask you about Red Square, Rusty. What was it like going to the Soviet Union, and what were the people like? How did they react?
Oh, yeah, they were well into it. It was great. It was sort of a different era, you know. And Putin was there, but he was definitely in a different headspace. You know, but it was trippy, you know, that I remember them telling us, you know, that while we're playing, there's like snipers on the different rooftops and stuff because we're playing in Red Square.
Oh,
and,
nice.
You know, it's, yeah. But it was magical. You know, we met Gorbachev and it's a really sort of interesting architecture there, you know, very unique.
Yes.
Of the dome buildings and all that stuff. And I was told that we were like the first rock band to play there. So,
yeah, well, that's certainly
maybe that's even true. I don't know.
Something to be said. Now, the Grammys, three times you were at the Grammys. Now, I remember listening to the Beatles channel on Sirius XM, and they were wondering, with all their storied history, how many times the Beatles made it to the Grammy Awards. And I think the answer was zero. But Paul showed up those three times, right?
Yeah. We've done it feels like, I don't know, like your home gig or something, which it usually is because we're playing in L.A. I think Grammys, so they usually do it at the Those are the staples, I guess, or the form or something. I guess the staples is where they do it. But, yeah, so it's funny, all these big arenas, you know, and stadiums, all these fancy names like Staples Center and Crypto, you know.
Not too corporate, crazy. Right?
Not too corporate. KFC.
Yeah.
Yeah, really charismatic names. But anyway, yeah, you know, that was, that's always fun.
Right.
We did, I think the last time we played there, actually, Joe Walsh and Bruce Springsteen and Dave Grohl came out and we played the end at the triple guitar solo, except it turned into a sextuple guitar solo or whatever it was. So that was fun.
Yeah. Now you met Paul in the studio through a producer friend of yours, and he played bass and sang background on your first record, Undressing Underwater is the name of that.
Yeah, Paul played, he played the bass, yes, sound backgrounds, and that was fun. He came up with a really great section too, because there was a section of the song that he called the rescue bit, because I said, there's a section here, I don't know how it's gonna go, we hear some chords and we'll figure it out. And so he calls me back the next day, he goes, yeah, it was really fun, you know, in the studio, and he goes, I have an idea for the rescue bit. And his idea was to throw in like an interesting instrument, like a flugelhorn or, you know, I don't know, oboe or something unique.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't expect, sort of. So he did. We put in the flugelhorn, and the guy that played it, his name's Proven Gregory, and he plays with Brian Wilson. He plays, you know, guitar and various horns and stuff like that with Brian. So that was really a treat too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty trippy, you know. Paul sitting there playing bass and just sort of learning the song, and he makes a mistake and he kind of curses himself, and it was like everybody does. You know, everybody like is hard on themselves when they're learning a song and you're trying to get it right and everyone's there and stuff. So that was super endearing.
Surreal, definitely. Now, the McCartney catalog, we were talking about this the other day. I haven't heard it live, but I don't know if you guys can pull out Hi, Hi, Hi or Junior's Farm or Uncle Albert out of the catalog. And do you guys rehearse those tunes?
Yeah, you know, we played so many songs over the years. But, yeah, we played those songs. Let's see, what did you say? Hi, Hi, Hi. We played, I don't know if we did that the last tour, but we played many tours.
Junior's Farm.
Junior's Farm, yeah, we did that the last tour. We played that a lot.
I missed that. Okay,
good
now.
Fun rocker.
Uncle Albert, I mean, that one's tough to play.
We've never played that one. Maybe it's, you know, a lot of sections.
Yeah.
I don't know, whatever, reasoning. But it just sort of never came up.
And
I guess if we really wanted to.
Yeah. Whatever the boss says.
I mean, we've done so many songs that you kind of, like, Benefit of Mr. Kite. That's not one you'd expect to play live, but we pull it off. And
right.
He's Leaving Home, we've done that. We've done, you know, Too Many People, which is off the solo bit. And, you know, when Paul, I guess Too Many People's from, like, 72-ish, around there, early Wings.
Right.
Or something.
I remember Mr. Kite. That was a Lennon tune that Paul inserted into the set list. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. He comes up with some left field kind of concepts sometimes, and we go, sure, yeah, great. You know, because all the material is so great that it's just fun to play whatever it is. So.
Right, and you know it's going to get a positive reaction, that's for sure. Now, we're speaking with the great guitarist Rusty Anderson tonight on the program. Now, you have you could hear the applause. Now, you have four albums out. Tell us about those.
Yeah, well, my first record is Undressing Underwater, and that's the one that Paul guested on.
Mm-hmm.
And a second one is called Born on Earth, and the third one, there was a song actually on that one, the radio, that we got some action on, which was called Where Will We Go, and that's sort of more of an acoustic vibe. And what was the one after that? That was RAA2, Rusty Anderson Afternoon 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I started calling it a band name because my my buddy Todd, who we still work together, and he plays bass, and we sing together, and, you know, do some writing together and stuff. Anyway, that's called Rusty Anderson Afternoon 2. And then the next one was called Rusty Anderson. That one's called RAA. And I love talking about myself in the third person. It's very fun. That was the last full record we did. And then since then, we've been sort of doing a series of singles, which is kind of fun. And I did a single called Firefly, and that's with Stuart Covlin from The Police playing drums.
Nice.
And, yeah. He's a friend of mine. We used to, back in the day, when I was, you know, working with various groups, and one of them was Animal Logic, with Stuart Copeland and Stanley Clark. And that was a really fun band. We did, you know, some recording and gigging and all that. And so Stuart, you know, and I stayed tight, even though the band only lasted a year or two, I guess, after that. But, so he played drums on this tune, Firefly, and that was really fun. And it's worth checking out. Actually, another cat named Ron Sexsmith wrote the lyrics. Mm-hmm. He's a fantastic singer-songwriter friend of mine.
And you have a new song called Cut the Chain.
Yes, Cut the Chain is not out yet, but it will be out shortly, maybe within the next week or so. And that's, I'm looking forward to that.
We will look for that.
But
yeah,
you know, we've done as a band, you know, like I sort of, when I'm not touring with Paul and I'm not doing, you know, the occasional recording with other people, I'm touring with my band or recording new songs with my band, and we've toured around. We've gone to through the U.S. a few different states, and the U.K. We did some gigs over there, and Iceland. That was really fun. That's the first time I'd actually been to Iceland, and that was kind of a really cool thing to see those huge waterfalls and the geothermal activity, and it's a very different vibe over there.
Oh, yeah, much different than here, that's for sure. We're speaking with Rusty Anderson tonight. He is the great guitar player. You'll know him from seeing him on stage with Paul McCartney. And your history, Rusty, let's go into that. You started a teenage band back in the day, and what was that called?
Well, that was called Eulogy.
Eulogy.
And I started playing when I was 8, and I think I was about maybe 13 or 14 when I started that band with some friends. And we had a lot of energy and a lot of, you know, everybody got good quick, you know, like the bass player, he sort of started playing bass so he could play bass within the band, you know, that kind of thing. And the singer was so funny because this guy Miles, who they said, oh, there's this kid, and he's from England. And we were like in eighth grade or something. And he goes, there's this kid from England that just started going to the school. We're like, really? Wow. So we meet him, and he turned out he was from Scotland, actually. But we forced him at gunpoint to be the lead singer. And so, we just hung out all the time and played gigs. And then we started playing all over the place. We started playing all these high schools and backyard parties. And we started playing a lot of clubs. And then we eventually auditioned for Clive Davis, and didn't quite get there, but he really dug the songs. We played with The Police. We played a bunch of gigs with Van Halen, Eddie Money, all sorts of people, The Runaways. And then after that band broke up, I started doing some studio work and working with various bands at the same time. And I played on the first Bangles record and played with Elton John and Sinead O'Connor, people like that. So that's actually how I met Paul, was through the studio thing, you know?
Right.
I think I'd done, what was it? I don't know. Lana Del Rey, Michael Bublé. Anyway, whoever it was that, right after that, I started talking on the phone to David Kahn, who's a good friend of mine, he's a producer, and he said, wow, I'm going to do a new McCartney record. And I said, wow, fantastic. And I was really happy because obviously Paul's Paul, he's amazing, and David's a great producer, and I was really excited to hear it. And he goes, yeah, I might need some guitar playing. I'm like, okay, well, count me in.
Yeah.
And then I sort of waited looking by the clock for about 2 months until I went to the studio in Hollywood, a studio called Henson, and we, you know, got together and, you know, first meeting Paul and his English friends and everything, it was such a trip. And I was kind of like buzzing, like seriously buzzing for like 2 or 3 days, like getting used to it. But the nice thing is that, you know, you go into the studio and we're talking and hanging out a little bit, and then we listen to some music and go, okay, let's go play this first song. And we get out there, and just being a musician and playing with other musicians is, it's really, spiritual. You know, it's like a bonding thing that it goes beyond language. It's its own language, and it's really cool, and it sort of makes everybody in their, come to their zone, and I really realized and appreciated it at that time, you know.
Now, you said you worked with Eddie Money, Rusty. He's a local guy from Long Island here, the late Eddie Money.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he grew up the block in Levittown here on the island. And how was Eddie to work with?
I never worked with him other than we did. Oh, actually, you know what? I did. I played on a song that he wrote for a movie called Back to the Beach, and I played the guitar on it. And we actually, in my earlier band, Eulogy, we opened up for him at a show, too. But I didn't hang out with him a whole lot, so I can't give you a lot of first-hand Eddie Money information, other than he seemed like a really nice guy. I think, you know, he liked to party a bit, and that's the one thing I remember from the live show. But, yeah. Talent, definitely a talent.
Eddie Mahoney, his real name is, actually.
Right.
Yeah. Local hero. And how about cool. Sir Elton? You opened up for Elton John?
No, actually, I played on his record. It was a record called Songs from the West Coast.
I remember that one, Yeah,
it was a good record. And anyway, so we came in and, you know, and Bernie Taupin was there, and he'd just hand some lyrics to Elton. He'll go, here's a set of lyrics, and he'd just give him a piece of paper, and he'd go out to the piano, and he'd look at it, and he'd start playing. Within 15 minutes, he had a song. And then we'd just sit by the piano, and I remember, like, running on the chords and asking about the chords and stuff, and then we start recording the song, and then it was done. It was just lightning fast. It was amazing.
Talented
and
guy.
What a sweet guy. Yeah,
yeah.
Really nice guy, really funny, and, you know, got a lot of cool stories, and a great guy. Billy Joel's he's a local for you too, right?
Yeah, he lives, I don't know if he's out here now, but he grew up in Long Island too, yeah.
Yeah, I know he's come and played on some shows with Paul we've done. And that was fun. He's a nice guy, obviously a big talent, and he's gotten a lot of recognition the last couple of years, I've noticed.
Yeah, well, his Madison Square Garden gigs are always high on everybody's list, and he did Shea Stadium with Paul when they closed Shea Stadium,
right?
Because the Beatles
exactly.
played there. Yeah, he came on with Paul, and
that's the gig we did. With
yeah,
him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good old Shea Stadium, which is no longer there anymore, but that's where the Beatles played in '64 or '65. I don't remember what year it was. But an old revered piece of New York City past, that's for sure. Now, how about Neil Diamond? That seems interesting that you would play with Neil.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a similar thing where I went into the studio, you know, years ago, and I played in a song, a Neil Diamond song called Don't Look Down, I think. And That was cool, and I remember it kind of, it's all sort of a blur in a way, because I remember doing that one and then doing one with Carole King, and I don't remember if she was involved with that somehow. But anyway, and then we did there's a big show over in England called Jules Holland, where they have a lot of, you know, big stars, you know, older legendary stars and newer ones. Like we've done gigs there with like Adele, and, you know, various artists. And Jules Holland is a fantastic piano player, and he's a big sort of celebrity over there in England.
Yeah, Squeeze.
And, he played in Squeeze. Mm-hmm. And then Neil Diamond came on. He played a gig there with us. And it's kind of cool because all the bands set up in a circle, so you're all sort of like around the campfire. and Neil Diamond's over there playing some songs, and then we'd play, and then the Black Keys would play or whoever, and it's always a kick. So that's the one thing I remember, Neil Diamond playing. He sounded great, and you know, he's classic.
Yeah, he is. You're exactly right. We're speaking with Rusty Anderson tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, here comes some sports your way, Rusty. How about the national anthem at Dodger Stadium? That must have been a thrill.
Yes. That was very surreal, because actually it was hyper real, because I went there. I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll play the national anthem, sure. And I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to play? So I sort of worked out a rendition. And then I got up there, just me and my guitar and my amp, and cranked it up. But the thing I didn't really think about before was that there was, like, no safety net. I was there. The whole stadium was full. I didn't have any band. There was no, you know, backup tracks or anything. It's just me and the guitar. And but then once I started playing and all the loud sound was coming through the PA and everything, it sort of put me at ease. But it was really, really a kick, you know,
yeah,
being out there.
55,000 people in the stands, yeah, that's definitely amazing. I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, that was a great Dodger game, too, by the way.
Okay, yeah. Is Paul a sports fan? I always wondered about that.
Yeah, he. I know he's big on, you know, English football or soccer,
yeah,
called over here. Yeah. And I think as of the last few years, he's gotten more into, like, basketball and some American football and things like that. Seen him at some games. I think, he gets into it. Really cool.
He has a house out here, too, Rusty. He lives out in the Hamptons.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's got a house on Long Island, too. Everybody lives here,
cool,
Rusty, except you. You got to get out here.
What dictates,
Rusty, when he's going to play the bass or when he takes out the Les Paul? How does that work?
Well, it really varies on the song, what he feels like comfortable playing on that song, and then we sort of switch around. I know Brian plays guitar, and then when Paul plays piano, then he plays bass.
Mm-hmm.
Or certain songs, if Paul's playing acoustic guitar, he's playing bass. And, you know, the beauty of it is it's we've been together as a band for over 20 years, and it's really awesome, because everybody came to the party as a seasoned player, and so everyone's feel is really good, and everyone is a multi-instrumentalist to some degree, so we can kind of switch out. I know, like, Wicks plays the guitar, like acoustic guitar occasionally on songs or bongos or whatever. He's the keyboard player.
Yeah.
And then Abe, you know, we all sing, and Abe's a fantastic drummer. There's one song he even played bass on, I think.
I think Abe is very animated. He is a great part of the band. Yeah, I always appreciated Abe's performances. And I think that's all I got for you, Rusty. You have anything you want to plug or anything you want to say?
No, not really. Just it's been fantastic talking to you, and hello everybody out there, and hope Long Island's rocking right now. It's the evening, right?
Yeah, we're looking at 9:05 here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's getting evening time. I'm actually in the West Coast, so I've got daylight still.
Attaboy. Woo-hoo. Yeah. And any upcoming tour that you could tell us about?
There's some stuff coming up, but I can't give you any dates yet because I don't have them.
Okay. Is that you or you with McCartney?
Both, actually. But stuff we're working on. So I don't have any dates for anybody yet, but keep your eyes peeled because stuff's coming up.
Right. The website. Give folks the website, Rusty.
Yeah, my website's rustyanderson.com. So you can go check that out. And, you know, Instagram or any of those fun things.
The website got some great,
some
great photos, some great merchandise on Rusty's website. Definitely go check that out, folks. It's a sight to behold. Well, Rusty, thanks for taking the time out of your Sunday night or afternoon for you out there to spend some with us here on Long Island. I wish you the best with your solo career with Paul. Give him our regards and tell him there's always a spot for him here if he'd like to come on.
I will do. It's my pleasure, Bill. Thank you for chatting with me. been fun.
You have a good night. That's Rusty Anderson, ladies and gentlemen. Up next, hour number two, Howie Carpin and the History of Sports Phone on the way. Back with Sports Talk New York right after this.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.